Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the gathering gloom over Afghanistan, where the 2,000th U.S. soldier was killed by Afghan allies, and the U.S. general in charge just told 60 Minutes that we're willing to sacrifice a lot for this campaign, but we're not willing to be murdered for it. A former United Nations political officer who worked in Afghanistan, Chris Fair, joins us to discuss an accelerated exit from Afghanistan and the likely civil war to follow. Then we'll examine another futile war in a failed state, Somalia, where Kenyan soldiers have just driven out the Al-Shabaab militia and captured the port of Kismayo that has long been used by pirates. Robert Young-Pelton, the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com, joins us to discuss the newly assertive Kenyan military and his article at Foreign Policy, Hijacked, How the UN Saved the Somali Pirates from the Brink of Extinction. Then finally, we will discuss what we won't be hearing in Wednesday night's presidential debate with Mattia Kramer, the senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project. She has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, Tough Talk for America, a guide to the presidential debates you won't hear. Joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer and a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And the Marine Corps General John Allen, the commander of the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan, on 60 Minutes on Sunday said, "We're willing to sacrifice a lot for this campaign, but we're not willing to be murdered for it." I guess morale has to be pretty low, doesn't it? If with these green on blue killings, what's your sense of what's happening in the field there with our troops?
Well, I think you pretty much nailed it. I mean, this has been going on now for quite a number of years. I'm surprised it hasn't drawn more attention than it has. I'm a little bit baffled by General Allen's comments, of course, because, you know, I think if you were to take a look at the broad campaign, we have indeed sacrificed quite a bit, and the gains are not quite evident to me. You know, we went into Afghanistan to oust al-Qaeda. Well, al-Qaeda's been ousted for quite some time. And at some point, the goal became, you know, defeating the Taliban. And I think that when the goal went from ousting al-Qaeda to defeating the Taliban, the United States didn't really appreciate that it was essentially pitting itself against Pakistan, right, in a sort of weird proxy war because the Taliban are their allies. And so we really found ourselves in the last couple of years trying to find some way of honorably getting out of Afghanistan, you know, if it's not cutting and running, then severing and sauntering. But the problem, of course, keeps just coming back to Pakistan. And they're pretty much have shown themselves to be very capable of doing everything in their power to undermine the kind of outcome that we'd like to see in Afghanistan. So it's really hard to understand what the benefits have been after all of the sacrifice of life and treasure.
And Christine Fair, you're a student of Pakistan as well as Afghanistan. What are the Pakistani leadership thinking? Presumably, since the joke's always been that it's not a country with a military, but a military with a country or an army with a country. Presumably, they must have thought about when the ISAF and the U.S. get out. And if they've been supporting the Taliban and they want them to take over Afghanistan, won't that mean that would therefore blow back on them, a radical regime in Afghanistan? Wouldn't that encourage radicals within Pakistan that the government is already having a hard time with?
So, I mean, this is what the Pakistanis officially say. I mean, this is the kind of rationale when they say, why would we be supporting the Haqqani network? Boy, what a bunch of untruths that are, you know. So this is the official story that the Pakistanis say. They tell this to Americans. They tell this to anyone that will listen. But that narrative is really fundamentally belied by a sort of larger look at the region. The reason why Pakistan has been so adamant in supporting the Haqqani network and the Afghan Taliban, and I know to your listeners who don't follow South Asia, it's going to sound insane, but the Pakistanis are absolutely fearful of India's ability to take advantage of any position in Afghanistan. And to Pakistan's credit, or to give some credibility to its claims, You know, the Indians have been able to expand their footprint relative to what it was before 9/11 under the U.S. security umbrella. And so the Pakistanis, in some sense, this goes all the way back to the first day when Pakistan became an independent state. Afghanistan opposed its admissions to the U.N. Afghanistan has taken a lot of positions that are deeply vexing to Pakistan, but it... In Pakistan's narrative, it does so at the urging, at the behest, at the instigation of, and with the support of India. So, from Pakistan's point of view, in some sense, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So they've been saying, the Americans are going to leave. You came in with a light footprint. You never adopted the right footprint. You outsourced your security to the Northern Alliance, which Pakistan views as an Indian proxy. And sure enough, you are indeed 11 years later, finally getting out. And so in some sense, that vindicates their strategy of never having let go of the Taliban and the Haqqani network in the first place. And so it's dealing with Pakistan's logic in this region is really quite maddening, I think, on a good day. And I don't think you'll find any U.S. official that's going to disagree with that assessment.
So already the NATO allies in ISAF, which I believe the U.S. military jokingly refers to the acronym ISAF as I Suck at Fighting.
Or I Saw Americans Fight, my other preferred.
Right. So they're already talking about getting out. The first 33,000 U.S. troops have already gotten out, the surge troops, that leaving 68,000 still there. So NATO has currently 108,000 troops, down from 150,000. What's going to happen if NATO, the rest of the NATO soldiers? By the way, they've taken 1,200 deaths compared to the United States 2,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they've got problems at home, right, with the Euro crisis, et cetera. So give us a sense of how the allies are they going to accelerate our timetable, or events on the ground going to accelerate our timetable?
Well, so when we talk about ISAF, we were really talking about a menagerie of actors. And some of those actors, even though they're a part of the NATO-ISAF coalition, their roles have not always been, to put it bluntly, combat effective. So the Germans, for example, have taken a lot of criticism because of their rules of engagement. So there's this thing called caveats. And they're national caveats. They're essentially limitations on what these countries can do in Afghanistan, and they're very much tied to the domestic politics, speaking to the point that you had alluded to. So when you actually, they actually have tools at NATO-ISAF where you can overlay the battlefield with a caveat to sort of see what is the effective force that you have on the ground that can actually execute certain capabilities. And so, this NATO thing has always been kind of an international fig leaf to what's been an American dominant process. And so many of the partners have pulled out, for example, the Brits have escalated their timelines. The French are under a lot of pressure. The Australians just have a handful of people left. So this is, very much becoming an American dominated affair. I think the bigger question, I think the bigger policy question that's really looming, that the reason why we had the surge in the first place was this fairy tale that the counterinsurgency, the so-called coindanistas or coinistas, as they're sometimes called, sold to the policy community. That is, that if we fight this population-centric counterinsurgency, that we'll be able to win. And that was the logic of the surge. And of course, yours truly, I was very dubious of the whole thing for a number of reasons. But in some sense, you had this entire cottage industry of experts, including David Kilcullen, among others, that were arguing for this kind of approach. And I think what's really become manifestly clear is that it has been a complete failure. And at the end of the day, we put in many more tens of thousands of soldiers. And what's come out of, and what benefits have we realized given the enormous cost, both in terms of life as well as treasury? And it's just really hard to come up with anything that's defensible.
With the 40% of the casualties coming from those crude IEDs, and essentially it was a whack-a-mole situation, wasn't it? They moved into Hamland and Hamland province, the Marines did. They did their job, but then the bad guys melted away, and now they're back. So
that's exactly it. I mean, I kind of use the example of the water balloon, right? You squeeze the water balloon in one place, and the water goes, it displaces someplace else. And I think one of the things that I've always found to be most disingenuous, and I will say disingenuous with full intent that I'm implying deception, a willing effort to manipulate data to deceive. I mean, every Friday they have this thing called the AFPAC Federation Forum, which is nothing but a psyop on the American people. And it's really scandalous, the degree to which there's been so much invested in trying to deceive the American public about the efficacy of what it is that we're doing. So going back to your point, like, you'll see reports that, you know, violence in X district in Helmand are down 30%. But what you don't see is that over there in neighboring Kandahar, violence is up an equivalent percent, or that violence in other districts are up, because essentially, as you said, you know, you put pressure on them in one place and they essentially squirt out to other venues. And so, you know, if you take a look at all of Afghanistan in a total picture, it's really hard to see what we've done that's not been completely reversible. I mean, there were places, you know, in the beginning of this conflict, like Kunduz, for example, that was largely Talib-free. And those large parts of Kunduz that have been at different times overrun by the Taliban, and that's just one area. So I, you know, looking at what we've done and how we've done it, I think it's really hard to make the case to the American public that we should continue being there in this counterinsurgency footing. It's costly. And by the way, one could also say that even if we took Pakistan support for the insurgency off the table and we just focused upon our own war planning, I think there's a lot to be desired in terms of how we understood the battle space. I mean, Jesus, we're still relying upon suspect translators. It's been 11 years, and we don't have language skills. I mean, give me a break. And on top of that, we've had an Afghan partner, obviously Hamid Karzai, that has been pretty much dedicated to remaining a becaped narco-kleptocrat. I mean, we know if we take the counterinsurgency literature seriously, and I'm not necessarily going to say that I do that, but we know that things like governance and accountability and transparency and rule of law, if there's to be any chance of counterinsurgency doctrine prevailing, you need to have those things in the host government. And I don't need to repeat the Afghan government does not in any modest way fulfill those criteria.
Right. Karzai was on 60 Minutes as well, he's somewhat outrageous in suggesting that the U.S. hasn't done enough. And I can imagine it makes people nuts to realizing this absolute, ludicrous, decorated martinet who, I mean, he was brought in by the same neocons that brought in Chalabi, so I'm not surprised. But there was a chance, and I think it was the time when you were working as a U.N. political officer. I remember speaking to Ambassador Galbraith at the time, when the election was so fraudulent that he was pushing to try and get for the U.S. to use the opportunity to get rid of Karzai, and then the U.N. guy, the Norwegian guy, basically thwarted the whole plan. What happened there? Was that a real opportunity to get rid of Karzai?
So, I mean, you know, I think you know I was also a long-term election observer during that fiasco. So there were a couple of problems. The Bush administration, because this was how the Bush administration saw the world, to them, Karzai was indispensable in the same way that Musharraf was indispensable. I mean, Bush had this very personality-driven assessment of the region and how we were going to form alliances. So I was there. You know, I haven't been to Afghanistan now in about 2 years. I'm leaving here in a couple of weeks. But, you know, I had been going there pretty regularly until 2010. And so in 2008, the Karzai election fraud machine was already ticking into gear. And I remember talking to people about this. And, of course, as the as we were moving into the election, by the time you get to 2009 and Obama kind of inherits this hot soup sandwich, the fraud, and by fraud I mean industrial strength fraud. I mean manipulating voter registration. At one point, you could go into the market and buy handfuls of voter registration cards for a ridiculous amount of nothing. So by the time the Obama administration had come in, the fraud had gone so far that it was really impossible to wheel that back. Now, unfortunately, Galbraith came in after much of the institutional fraud had already been put into place. And so by the time the election was actually held, there really wasn't much you could do. Now, it is true that in the contesting of the election and all of the stuff that happened afterwards, that is when Kayyedi really lived down to the expectations of the UN in Afghanistan. Because, he was absolutely of the view that the best way to go forward was not to force this into any sort of, what would have happened in extrema would have been Karzai having a showdown with Abdullah. And Kayyedi, for whatever reason, wanted to preclude that. In point of fact, I don't know that even if there had been a runoff, that the outcome really would have been any differently. This is one of those elections where Karzai probably would have won even without the industrial strength fraud. And that's because the alternatives to Karzai didn't really have the national support base that one really needs to pull that off.
And a national support base means what? A network of narco-kleptocracy.
true. That's absolutely true. And of course, in Afghanistan, a lot of these patronage networks also have overlapping ties with, clan and ethnic affiliation. So Abdullah didn't have any of the weight in the south, the Pashtun south. Abdullah himself, his base is up in the north. So Karzai is one of those bizarre individuals that can pull. He's got the alliances in the north, but he is himself a Pashtun from Kandahar. So he's got those southern Pashtun ties. So by the way, after Karzai, elections always do produce alternatives. You sort of look at who's out in the field. It's hard to see who's going to be able to consolidate a position across the different parts of Afghanistan, especially when there's been so much ethnic fragmentation as a consequence of the war and the way in which the international community has interacted with Afghanistan.
Well, that gets us to the final question here, which is what's going to happen when the U.S. pulls out? Everybody seems to think that civil war is inevitable.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I hear. Now, let's be very clear what pullout means. Pullout does not mean, like the image of the fall of Saigon, the last helicopter pulling, as many people that could be safely shoved into a helicopter and flying away. The U.S. has made it very clear that they want to stay in some kind of a long-term committed relationship with Karzai or with Afghanistan. The problem is that Karzai wants the benefits of U.S. support without any of the political costs. And so you'll see him running around, kissing up to Emma Dainajad and so forth. And so Karzai knows that when the Americans leave, his regime is pretty fragile. But because his political position is fragile and because much of what the U.S. and NATO is doing in Afghanistan is deeply unpopular, he also wants to be in the constant position of the grouse, just constantly complaining about how horrible we are and how we haven't done enough and how we're all killing all these innocent civilians. So he's in a really tough place. But from my point of view, as an American, he's squandered the last 11 years. He has, during this time, the world had its checkbooks open. There was an opportunity to do something real, but he was really not able to overcome the sort of kleptocratic impulses of his regime. And, I'll tell you, everyone knows this. More money is being exported to Dubai than is Afghanistan's gross domestic product.
And that a lot of that is our money, right?
Precisely. And so, there, you know, if the American population understood how much money is being taken out of our pocket and basically being shoved into the pocket of these Afghan elites, so they can have their narco palaces, their poppy palaces in Dubai. I mean, it really is outrageous. And then to hear Karzai opine about how we haven't done enough. I mean, really, it's a little bit much. It's too much to take. It really is.
Well, let's not get upset you. We'll leave on that note.
This stuff gets me riled up.
Right, I know. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you. Have a great evening.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer and a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Somalia.
I heard his fiancée got a letter that told how Billy died that day. The letter said that he was a hero. She should be proud he died that way. I heard she threw the letter away.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer, and the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. He's had a firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, Licensed to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Hijacked, How the UN Saved the Somali Pirates from the Brink of Extinction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young-Pelton.
Hi, Ian. Always a pleasure.
So, Robert, the Kenyans, or the African Union, I think they're largely Kenyan, along with some Somali forces, appear to have driven, or actually, I think they didn't, Al-Shabaab actually just leave Kismayo, the port?
The Kenyan army fights probably a little bit more enthusiastically with their press releases than they do on the ground. They actually landed north of the city. And Al-Shabaab did mention that they're making an organized retreat. It remains to be seen whether they're actually retreating or not, but the Kenyans have never actually fought a war before, so this is their first war, and they tend to, overstep their capabilities sometimes. So it's yet to be seen.
Well, apparently, though, they're in the ensuing power vacuum, a number of influential clan figures have been murdered in the past few days, presumably by Al-Shabaab. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a big race for Kismayo. You know, Kismayo is the second largest port in Somalia. It's just south of Mogadishu. And for many, many years, Kismayo has kept their port fees down so that people will drop off, let's say a shipload, they'll drop off two or three things in Mogadishu and then go down south to Kismayo. And Al-Shabaab and the local governor have been making a lot of money off of this as discount port service. So what Kenya's trying to do is dislodge them from Kismayo to cut off their source of income.
So when the Kenyans say that they are hosting 650,000 refugees from Somalia, and they've had instability on their border with the murder of some foreign tourists or aid workers, do they have a case for needing to invade their northern neighbor in the name of stability?
I think so. I think any nation has the right to defend their borders, even if they have to go slightly inside the other borders. But if you look at the history of Kenya and Somalia, Somalia has always had sort of a buffer zone. The British used to call it Jubaland. And if you remember the stories about shiftas and cattle rustlers and poachers, you know, Somali clans and gangs used to come south into Kenya and steal cattle. So historically, there's been a history of Kenyan troops chasing, you know, bandits up into Somalia. But this is a much, much bigger thing. This is about 5,000 traditional ground troops being paid about $1,028 a month by the Amazon organization, which is a part of AU, but is essentially bankrolled by the African Union, which is bankrolled by EU and the United States. So it's a major political shift in the region, and they want to have control over that southern boundary. So you're going to see a lot of people squabbling. The basic clans, the Ogadanis, the Kenyans, the Somalis, are all going to be fighting over who controls that political structure around Kismayo.
So Kismayo, though, was a port for pirates, wasn't it?
No, Kismayo, strangely enough, most people think pirates are everywhere. Piracy has always been north, in the central areas and up into Puntland. Al-Shabaab actually has kept pirates and piracy out of the south. There have been bandits that have been labeled as pirates. If you remember the Marie Dijot, who was kidnapped and then she died, and then the British couple whose husband was shot and the wife was then ransomed. These people are very careful to put plywood between criminal acts and terrorist acts because you can't pay ransoms to terrorist groups. So whenever you hear these people talk, they say, oh, no, we're criminals, we're not terrorists, or we're terrorists, we're not criminals. But they are linked, and what Kenya is trying to do is just simply grab a hold of the control of that region to, first of all, flush out al-Shabaab, but also to get a handle on this criminal activity.
So, again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer, and the founder and publisher of Somalia Report. He has an article at Foreign Policy Hijacked, How the UN Saved the Somali Pirates from the Brink of Extinction. And obviously, we want to talk about that. But just to finish up on al-Shabaab, you know, it's always said in the same breath, al-Shabaab, al-Qaeda affiliated or whatever. And we keep hearing about al-Qaeda's ubiquitous reach all around the world, and it's hard to get a handle on whether they really, how much of it is exaggeration, how much of it's real. Give me your assessment of this, their affiliation, how real they are, and whether this is going to be another fertile ground for al-Qaeda.
Well, historically, you have to go back. Remember that this area, the Swahili area, has always clashed with the sort of inland animist Christian. And if you also go back not too recently, you'll find out that this was actually the nexus of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And they blew up the embassy in Tanzania, and they blew up another one in Kenya, and they tried to blow up one in Uganda, but it was thwarted. And there's been a very robust anti-terrorism program to root out and kill those original members of al-Qaeda. So al-Qaeda is very real in that area. Secondly, al-Shabaab was the more fundamental, the Wahhabist element of the Islamic courts, which took over Somalia and then was kicked out by Ethiopia, which then created sort of this Frankenstein called al-Shabaab.
Now, Robert, was that an export from our wonderful allies, the Saudis, who export Wahhabism? Are they responsible for?
If you look at the coast of Africa, there are very strong Muslim communities, and some of those Muslim communities feel downtrodden, and they align themselves with almost missionary zeal. And you'll see that some elements, even within Nairobi and some of the internal cities, are very much aligned with, you know, return to the old roots. And Gulf and Saudi sponsors go out of their way to fund groups like that, much like, you know, Baptist missionaries want to reach out and find like-minded people all around the world. It went kind of crazy when bin Laden went there. Remember, he moved to Khartoum, and he began to actively support a number of people who were planning bombing attacks against the U.S. So there's no sort of Saudi government payroll, but yes, there is an affinity between the Wahhabist government of Saudi Arabia and a lot of the coastal Swahili areas.
Well, of course, we all remember under President George H.W. Bush that the U.S. intervened in Somalia largely for humanitarian reasons, because there was massive starvation. And then it ended up in the sort of infamy of Black Hawk Down, and President Clinton quickly got out of there. So there's a kind of bitter taste, I think, in terms of America about Somalia. Is it a permanently failed state? I mean, is it redeemable, rescuable?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, on Western terms, we're trying to reconstruct the colonial thing called Somalia, which was made out of clans, which then turned into protectorates. And a lot of modern Somalis want a unified Somalia. But when you actually go to Somalia, you won't find lawlessness. You'll find all these small regional governments doing just fine with their own traditional and sort of regional government. So there's a lot of friction between an outside entity, which in this case is the UN, which has babysat Somalia for 20 years, to try to make it look like it did 20-some-odd years ago, back when it dissolved into civil war. But the problem is that Somalis want to create their own state, and it doesn't necessarily look like the map that the UN has out. It includes Somaliland, which is now separate in the north, Puntland, which is semi-autonomous, Galmudug, which is a lawless area in the center, and then the southern part, which is where all the money comes from and where all the famine and all the aid goes to.
So let's turn then to Robert Young-Pelton, to your article at Foreign Policy Hijacked, How the UN Saved the Somali Pirates from the Brink of Extinction. Now, you just mentioned how the UN are still insisting on this old kind of colonial model that has little to do with the ethnic reality on the ground. But how in God's name could the United Nations save pirates from extinction? I mean, what happened?
Well, the first thing is that the UN is not monolithic. So on one hand, you can have an agency basically lecturing local governments in Somalia, saying you have to take action against the pirates. You have to train security forces and kick these pirates out. And then on the other hand, you have a group called the Somali-Eritrean Mining Group, which is watching the 20-year-old arms embargo, which was set in place when the militias went crazy back in the early 90s. And they are monitoring anybody, and that includes the CIA, the United States, anybody who has a weapon that isn't authorized by the UN. So Puntland, which is the region in the northeast corner, waited for years and years and years for the UN to say, okay, here's the money, go start this. And they couldn't wait anymore, so they went to the UAE, and the UAE said, here, we'll pay you about $10 million, go out and hire some trainers, which happened to be the old Executive Outcomes Group, and put together a 1,000-man anti-piracy group with helicopters, fast boats, and aviation assets, everything, a real army.
Now, that was put together by an ex-CIA guy, wasn't it?
It was a group of people. It wasn't just one. It was an ambassador. It was an ex-CIA.
Yeah, Pierre Prosper was one of them.
Yep, and then also Lafosse Lutink. I can't pronounce his name properly, but he was one of the founders of Executive Outcomes.
And that was the South African mercenary group, right? The Executive Outcomes.
Right, exactly. Which doesn't exist anymore, but the basic people have been working in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they came in as trainers, and they trained up the Somali force that then set their sights on specific pirate groups in specific areas sometime in June. And what was happening was the monitoring group of the UN was strong-arming the UAE and Puntland and the Somali government to stop this because it was the largest single force inside Somalia. And what they did is they threatened it with sanctions. And the UN can take three anonymous people and actually sanction your travel and your bank accounts. And there is no court of recourse. So it's a very serious thing if they recommend sanctions. So the reason I wrote this article is because I talked to the folks at the SCMG, and I talked to spent quite a bit of time on the ground with the mercenary group and in pirate areas, and I thought it was a good thing that they were actually chasing the pirates out. And then on June 6th, the program was entirely shut down just before the UN report came out. So my guess was that the UAE was threatened with sanctions if they didn't immediately stop funding this activity. So they had pirates on the run. They had a pirate who had a super tanker who was moving it around trying to keep it away from the South Africans, and another chemical tanker, and then suddenly it just stopped. All these people were told to pack up, get out of the country. And when I read the report, it was just blistering about how sanctions should be brought against Lafosse and the South Africans. And I was looking for the part where it was going to say the same thing about the pirates. And it didn't. And I called the UN and I said, explain this. And they said, oh, well, we can't sanction the pirates because then you couldn't pay the ransoms to free the people. So that was enough to
We were just talking, Robert Young-Pelton, about in the first segment about how the UN blew the opportunity to get rid of Karzai with a massive fraud in the elections. I mean, this is just another example of this wonderful bureaucracy run amok.
Right, and the difference is that Somalia is a ward of the UN ever since the government fell apart in 91. The UN has been given responsibility for this orphan, and Somalis have continually tried to create their own institutions, and they've been smacked down by the UN because it doesn't match the map that the UN puts out. And the map that the UN puts out glues all these beautiful places together like a country, but it's not. It's just four very separate, different places.
So let's then return to this military invasion by the African Union troops, largely Kenyan soldiers, funded, I guess, when you say they're funded by the EU and by the United States, could you describe them as mercenaries? I mean...
Well, here's the reason. What they've done is they've done the legal work so that you can't technically call them mercenaries, but to the Somalis, they're foreign invaders, which was the whole reason why al-Shabaab came to such strength, because they don't want foreign countries, particularly neighbors, to invade their country and to dictate how to run their country. And the Djibouti Accord, which was created after the Ethiopians invaded and were pushed out again, was specifically to keep neighbors from meddling. That's why you see Ugandans and Burundians and Djiboutians. So when Kenya invaded, it was very, very embarrassing. So they had to rewrite all these rules to make them peacekeepers, even though they said we're going all the way to Kismayo, we're going to kick out al-Shabaab. So once again, they've magically been transformed into legally conforming mercenaries.
But presumably the U.S. has an interest in that. They have a lot of activity down there, aren't there? Ships and drones, and isn't there an anti-Al-Qaeda strategy? You pointed out that one of the first targets that the Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, went after were the embassies nearby in Africa. So,
The U.S. has their new proxy forces. So in Libya, in Somalia, you don't see very many Americans on the ground. You might see a handful here and there. But what they're doing is they're using proxy forces. So they literally fly aircraft that have no markings and pretend like they're Somalis out of Djibouti and do raids inside Somaliland and Puntland. They train up security forces using, you know, U.S. money. So they're very active in that region, but they stay away from it. They stay on the ships, they stay in the Seychelles and Djibouti, and they don't have a base, per se, in the country.
No boots on the ground, but then really running the show, though.
Right. Well, you can find them by the airport. There's a CIA base right by the airport as you land in Mogadishu, and I bumped into trainers out in the wilderness training the anti-terrorism forces. But you won't see any large, not like Afghanistan or Iraq, or any such large contingents in there.
Well, we were just speaking earlier about the surge in Afghanistan and how it's essentially amounted to nothing because of the kind of whack-a-mole nature of these things, where the insurgents just melt off, and the first guest described it as a water balloon that you squeeze. Is this the same situation here, where al-Shabaab are just going to melt off and come back?
No, the big difference is that we don't want to grab the tar baby. We don't want to go into Somalia because we know it's going to be very difficult coming out. In Afghanistan, we went in and we're trying to figure out how to get out. There was no surge. Numerically, there was no surge in troops. There was a reassignment and they were rotating some people, but we never had a major offensive to remove the Taliban. We sort of did it here or there, what they call centers of gravity. But all the Taliban have to do is sit in the tea shop and wait until we pick another center of gravity and go back to work.
But so al-Shabaab, is there a way that this can work and that you could get rid of the instability and in Somalia? I mean, what?
Yeah, well, Somalia is very different. Somalia has a huge diaspora that's extremely aggressive in investing and helping. Most Somalis are very sophisticated. You can go to the smallest town in the middle of central Somalia and meet a guy from Philadelphia who used to drive a cab who retired from Somalia who speaks perfect English. It's a very different dynamic there, and Somalis are very, very adept at building, reconstructing, training. And it's very impressive. If you go on the ground, and every time somebody says, well, lawless nation, you would be very surprised how efficient it is.
Well, that's very surprising, and we should talk some more about it, but we've run out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer, and the founder and publisher of SomaliReport.com. He has had a firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He has an article at Foreign Policy Hijacked, How the UN Saved the Somali Pirates from the Brink of Extinction. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what you won't be hearing in the presidential debate on Wednesday.
Children grow, they grow with what they see. And in these times where paranoia closes in, power and hate are rampaging disease. In our minds we build the blocks to what we need. In our minds we're reaching out for peace. And in our hearts we know of such the hills to climb. In our hearts a sense of master feed.
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other? Like you would to a sister or a brother. Cut this cosmopolitan style.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mattia Kramer, Senior Research Analyst at the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. She's the lead author of the new book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. And she has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, Tough Talk for America, a guide to the presidential debates you won't hear. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mattia Kramer.
Well, thanks for having me.
And the presidential debate, the first one on Wednesday night, takes place in Colorado, which was recently the scene of a hideous massacre, one of a series of massacres where lone gunmen seem to want to break the record of how many innocents that they can kill with firearms that are so readily accessible in this country. The issue of gun control will not come up, right, in this debate. There's no way in the world that either of those two candidates are going to talk about gun control.
Oh, very unlikely. It tends not to make for a very juicy talking point for these political campaigns, so we're likely not to hear even a word about gun control.
And, I mean, do you think that the journalists that we have, these people that are supposed to stimulate the debate, are they going to bring it up? I mean, it's still the wound is still fresh, isn't it, in Colorado?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. One of the, in this piece that I have out, a guide to the debates that you won't hear, I'm talking about these major issues that we're not going to hear on Wednesday night or in the forthcoming presidential debates. And part of the reason for that is that we have national media outlets that allow talking points to pass as news. Instead of media outlets that shine a light on the deeper issues at play underneath those talking points. And so I don't know that we'll hear about gun control. I'd be surprised if we did.
Well, I know that the piece that you've written in the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, Mattia Kramer, Tough Talk for America, a guide to the presidential debates that you won't hear, are really about the big issues. And, of course, the economy is looming large. But What do you expect to happen there in terms of the way that the debate is framed? Is that the Republicans are basically saying that the fiscal situation is dire, and everybody but the Wall Street people who got us into this mess have to tighten their belt. I mean, can't Obama get around that absurdity?
Well, unfortunately, Obama has played into the deficit reduction talk. And so what we're hearing right now, this debate we're going to hear on Wednesday, it's going to be a lot about deficit reduction. And deficit reduction is going to be important when the economy is stronger. But all of this constant harping on debt and deficit, it eclipses the issue at hand, which is the economy and getting us out of this mess. And if we undertake urgent deficit reduction right now, it makes it all the more difficult to let the economy recover, because government spending cuts create layoffs, and that has negative effects throughout the economy. Whereas if we undertake deficit reduction when the economy is stronger, it'll be much easier to achieve, because we'll have people back to work, they'll be paying more in taxes, and fewer people will qualify for government assistance. But these are things that we're just not going to hear on Wednesday. We're just going to hear the harping on debt and deficit.
But you would think, though, that the president could make a case, and frankly, he should have made it the case in the first day he was in office. Instead of rescuing those people on Wall Street, which is, of course, a subject for another discussion. I mean, the long and the short it is, they've been made whole. And yet it's the Wall Street types like Pete Peterson, the Wall Street billionaire, who's driving. He's the money behind this deficit hawk business. He's the guy that underwrote and paid for the staff for the Simpsons-Bowles Commission. And so I can't believe it that these Wall Street guys who almost destroyed the economy are now the ones that are self-righteously telling us that everybody but them have to tighten their belts. And they're not going to pay any more taxes, by the way. I mean, you know, they get away with 15%.
That's right. And you make an important point, which is we have to look at what's underneath this message of debt and deficit, because right now Americans, by and large, we're hearing it so often that regular people of all walks of life are now afraid or fearing debt and deficit as this major issue facing our nation. But as I say in this piece, if you woke up tomorrow and saw that the federal government ran a balanced budget, but you'd lost your job, would you celebrate? And the idea is ludicrous. Of course not. The first priority should be jobs and the economy, and then deficit reduction after that. But because, as you're saying, certain people have made it a priority to talk about debt and deficit, that's eclipsing all else in our national conversation.
Again, I'm speaking with Mattia Kramer, who's a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, and she's the lead author of a new book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget, and she has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, Tough Talk for America, A Guide to the Presidential Debates You Won't Hear. So let's turn to taxes. They're obviously an uncomfortable subject for Mitt Romney, since he refuses to release his tax returns in a way that's just breathtakingly arrogant, but neither the Obama White House nor our feckless press have been able to shame him into releasing his taxes. What do you expect to be said there? Because, you know, the one thing that I don't think will be said, and you've pointed this out, is, by the way, we pay the lowest taxes in the world. What in God's name are we complaining about?
Yeah, that's right. So we never hear this, and this is something that we should hear. We're grown-ups. We should hear from someone in a leadership role, and it ought to be someone in the White House, should say taxes are at their lowest point that they've been in more than half a century. And on the taxes that we're paying right now, we can't afford things that the general American public believes to be top priorities, whether it's food safety or Medicare or education. The taxes we're paying right now, they're not going to cut it to fund those major, major priorities. And instead, we're not hearing that. Instead, we're hearing lowering taxes or broadening the base and lowering rates, all sorts of things that just mask the issue underneath, which is that taxes are at the lowest that they've ever been. We have a tax code full of tax loopholes, credits, deductions, and it makes it easy for people of many income levels, but in particular people who are wealthy, to avoid paying taxes by exploiting the complexity of our tax code.
So is this just to be expected, though, Mattia Kramer, that the politicians pander and people, don't seem to want to deal with reality? I mean, we have a history of Jimmy Carter sort of tried to be serious and, you know, sat in front of a fire with a cardigan on, talked about lowering the thermostat, and he was ridiculed. And this sunny optimist, Ronald Reagan, showed up and made all kinds of ridiculous promises about a shining city on a hill, and he got elected.
Yeah, we absolutely bear some of the responsibility. So we already mentioned a few moments ago that the media bears some responsibility for packaging sound bites as real news, but we also bear a responsibility here, and that's in allowing sound bites and that optimism, that untruthful optimism, to be fed to us by candidates for office. We opt to hear only that sunny message instead of what we should know better, and so we bear some of the responsibility, and of course. These candidates bear some of the responsibility, too, for evading the real issues and harping on things that just make for good, flashy moments on national primetime television.
But it's hard to believe that given how this 47% of victims who rely on government handouts and who don't want to take responsibility for their lives, as Romney put it to his friends that he was talking to, in that fundraiser down in Boca Raton, Florida. That's been, of course, become both a campaign commercial for the Obama administration and pretty much gone viral. It's hard to believe that taxes won't come up. But again, isn't there a simple argument that Obama can make? The relationship between Romney's one percenters who don't pay taxes or pay 15% and the rest of us who pay considerably more, I have a feeling that is going to be a lasting legacy, that at least if anything comes out of this campaign, is the fact that the average American, surely, if they're paying any attention at all, have got to come away from this realizing that our system of taxation is completely unfair.
Yeah, I think we're getting there, but it's slow progress. I mean, it's hard to convince the American public that we should be paying more in taxes when we've been hearing, you know, for our entire lives that, you know, it's like an American birthright to not be bothered with taxes or to pay as low taxes as possible. And you know, we shouldn't pay one penny more than is necessary. But the things that Americans believe to be priorities for this country, you know, interstate highways, for example, these major things, we can't afford them on the taxes we're now paying. And I think you're right, Ian, that we're slowly getting towards a point where folks recognize that things are deeply amiss. But whether people recognize that we ought to be paying more in taxes, that I'm not sure about.
Well, let's turn then to Medicare, or an argument that's bound to take place between Romney, who says he's going to get rid of Obamacare, and Obama, who presumably will defend the Affordable Care Act, which he's been appallingly bad at selling. So what do you expect to happen there?
Well, we're going to hear from both candidates about the proposals, which we by and large already know. Barack Obama will say that he's going to protect Medicare exactly as it is, and Mitt Romney has his plan to give seniors vouchers to buy private health insurance, you know, in 10 years from now. And neither of those proposals get at the issue that is the reason healthcare is a headliner, and that's because endless cost growth in healthcare is breaking the bank, whether for the federal government paying for Medicare or for regular people, you and me, buying health insurance in this country. Healthcare costs are out of control. Neither of those proposals get at that issue. So what we need to see from a candidate is talk about how to actually contain growth in medical costs. And there are ways of doing it. There are promising proposals. One way is to start to cut out waste in our healthcare system. Some estimates put waste at around 30% of the trillions we spend on healthcare in this country, and neither candidate is talking about that. Instead, we just hear protect Medicare, preserve Medicare. Those are nice sentiments. We deserve to hear a lot more than that.
Well, there is a difference between the two candidates and in terms of national security and foreign policy. The incumbent, the president, Obama, does seem to be trying to get the United States out of these losing expensive wars, whereas Romney seems to be wanting to get us into wars. He says we should be more assertive in against Iran and against Syria. But neither candidate is talking about seriously dealing with the massive waste and fraud in the Pentagon.
Yeah, so this is a remarkable statistic. So when Americans are polled, the general public, the American public, folks say that they'd like to see military spending cut by 18%. That's a huge number. They want to see vast reductions in military spending. Right now, the military defense spending is nearly 20% of the federal budget, and Americans want to see that deeply reduced. And yet, our candidates live in another universe on this issue. Neither party talks about really reducing military spending in the way that would coincide with what Americans say they want. And instead, we hear pledges to protect the Pentagon from cuts or to vastly reduce defense spending, and it's just totally out of tune with the public.
Well, just in the last minute then, the education. All presidents say they're going to be the education president, but, education is just going down, down, down. The state of California, it's a disaster. So just a last word on that.
Yeah, well, we're hearing all about deficit reduction, and an absolute travesty of that is that education gets grouped in with everything else as something that ought to be cut, while we're hearing folks say we have to reduce deficits for the kids so that we don't saddle the coming generation with debt. Well, that's just nonsense. If you think about education as the most important investment in the future of young people, to cut education programs means that they will live in a future where they can't afford a college education, where our education system isn't worth pursuing anyhow, this is perhaps the most pressing issue that faces this country, and yet we hear almost nothing about education in this election season. And we deserve better. We deserve to hear about this issue and what the candidates will truly do to return our education system to what was once by far the best in the world.
Well, Mattia Kramer, I thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, great to be here, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mattia Kramer, who's a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. She's the lead author of the new book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget, and she has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, Tough Talk for America, A Guide to the Presidential Debates You Won't Hear. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.